I've had a lot of people reaching out to me over this weekend and seeing if we're okay. I know a lot of you heard about the tornadoes in Nebraska. I can tell you that so far, as of this recording, everybody that I know is okay. Some people have lost their homes. Some good friends of mine have lost their homes. So please keep them and their families in your prayers. But so far, I haven't heard of anybody in Omaha losing their life from the storm. So I'm grateful to God for that. And please keep praying that continues to be the case. Hello and welcome to the Griswold Podcast on iCode Media. Today, I want to talk about an article I read and the implications of that article on optometry. Please enjoy the discussion or the thought-provoking monologue, so to speak. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast, write a review, share it with your friends, and support those who support us. We've had wonderful success recommending Verilux XR Track to our patients. Verilux XR Track lenses are a revolutionary advancement in progressive lens technology, powered by behavioral artificial intelligence and individual measurements. These lenses transform the predicted visual behavior profile into a personalized visual experience. Verilux X-Track lenses are meticulously designed to adapt to each patient's unique near vision behavior, ensuring up to 25% wider near vision zones for an unparalleled comfort during those close-up tasks. Imagine a lens that not only corrects but enhances, allowing for continuous comfort and impeccable precision. It's time to elevate your patient's visual experience with Verilux XR Track. Provide your patients with a lens that caters to their dynamic visual needs, making every detail crystal clear. Don't just correct vision, perfect it. I want to talk about the MyDay multifocal for a sec. We had the opportunity to do a preclinical trial with this lens this last summer, and there were a couple things that I thought were really helpful. The first one is that it is different than a lot of the multifocals that we've used before in our practices, where patients, especially early emerging presbyopes, really managed it didn't cause a lot of additional distance blur for them. And the other thing that was really helpful was, because we've never been involved in a clinical trial before, was to understand the sort of questions that we might ask our patients. And we ask our patients a lot of questions about their satisfaction with a contact lens, but what we weren't doing was actually having them score that themselves. So one of the parts of this that was really interesting to me was asking patients on a scale of 1 to 10 how they would score their vision, how they would score their comfort in their current lenses, and then how they would do the same on their new lenses. And it showed me a lot of times where patients would say they were happy, might rate their vision as a 6 or a 7. And then it also reframed their thinking about their current satisfaction in their lenses and allowed me to open up the door to offering other solutions. So if you haven't tried something like that in your clinical practice, I would encourage you to. And I would also encourage you to try the MyDay multifocal for your patients. What do you think about your macular degeneration supplements for patients in category 1 through category 4? Do you think you have a really good way to distinguish between what type of supplement you're using and why you're using it? I'd encourage you to check out the evidence behind MacuHealth. We've used it in our practice for a number of years now, and we have a real great solution for patients in category 3 and 4, as well as supplements for patients who don't need the full AREDS formulation. We've been really impressed in our practice by the way it performs and also by the patient acceptance of those supplements. And MacuHealth has also been a great partner in our practice to help us with resources and tools to help us describe and define why their supplements are more bioavailable than some of the things that patients can find at a supermarket or a drugstore. And the most important thing for me about having a supplement in our practice for patients to have access to is I can know whether or not they're getting exactly what I'm prescribing. So that seems to be really helpful for my patients because they're not scouring through the aisles trying to pick up something and having that 10-minute evaluation of what type of supplement they need. So if you haven't started using MacuHealth in your practice yet, you can find all their information in the show notes, and they definitely have something that is worth your patient's time and worth your patient's vision. So, you know, I think in a lot of ways, this discussion or this topic today is about what the future of healthcare holds in the country. And so, you know, I read this article from Baker's ACS Review, and I'm just going to read the article, and then I'll kind of give you some some of my takeaways from it and maybe stimulate some other thoughts. You know what's going on in our profession. And essentially it's, is private practice for all physicians, not just optometrists, is it a dinosaur on the road toward extinction is the title of this article. So it says, physicians are continuing their migration to employed models from private practice as costs soar and reimbursements decline. According to new data from consulting firm Avalere, in a study sponsored by the Physicians Advocacy Group, more than 127,000 physicians moved to employment from 2019 to 2023. Around 78% of physicians were hospital or corporate employed by January 2024. 78%. So 22% of physicians are independent at this point. Additionally, quote, roughly 8,100 private practices were acquired by hospitals or corporations in 2022 and 2023, and 19,100 physicians became employees of hospitals or other corporate entities, up by 5.1% since 2022. Only 44% of physicians own their practice as of 2022, and according to the American Medical Association report, compared with 74% in the early 1980s. The report cited regulatory and administrative burdens and economic pressures that have forced physicians to shift to hospital healthcare system settings. Private practice physicians are becoming more and more rare in American healthcare. This is by design and is not random, Kenneth Candido, MD, CEO and president of Chicago Anesthesia Associates, told Bakers. Large systems are siphoning off private practice physicians and are buying or consolidating practices exponentially. Those who hold out find a shrinking referral base, and those formerly loyal to them are being compelled to exclusively refer within the system. It's a dirty business and a dirty, underhanded game that administrators are playing to monopolize their business models. Dr. Candido added that the referral process has become weaponized as hospitals continue to grow, competition is shrinking. Private practice physicians have lost their power in healthcare because their patient bases have dried up, as hospital systems have gobbled up the patients through their extensive network of non-physician practitioners. The few physicians who have remained in private practice have been gobbled up. Thomas Pilura, a physician and attorney in Leroy, Illinois, told Bakers. About 80% of physicians who own their practices said the ability to negotiate higher payment rates with insurance companies influenced their decision to sell their practice, according to the AMA report. Health systems and hospitals are not the only entities gobbling up physicians. Retail clinics, urgent care clinics, telehealth platforms, and private equity firms are also racing to acquire physicians. United Health Group owned Optimum, the largest employer of physicians, a parent company of ASC chain SCA Health, added 20,000 physicians in 2023. Most recently, the company's string of acquisitions, Optum, announced plans to purchase financially troubled Stewards Healthcare, a 1,700 physician group. The private practitioner, unless they are in plastic surgery or dermatology, are essentially dinosaurs on the road toward extinction, Dr. Candido said. The old mantra of divide and conquer has been expertly used by the major healthcare systems to pick off the lone or small group practitioners and has been extremely lethal and effective, end quote. So what do we take from this? There's a lot to take from this. From an optometric standpoint, I want to discuss this article. We'll start with some upsides and some downsides that I've kind of pondered a little bit. And then I'll kind of reflect on some other things that I think are driving forces, and then just ultimately challenges for patients when these types of things happen. So this shift of physicians towards employed models rather than private practice due to the rising costs and failing reimbursements of our models has to mean, from a physician standpoint, that we're on that track. Now, doesn't mean we're on that track from hospital settings. It doesn't mean we're on that track just from corporate chains or just from private equity chains. But the problems that are occurring with general physicians, internal medicine physicians, other physicians that are not kind of specialized, they're going to plague us as well. The same types of things as far as stagnant reimbursements, inability to negotiate fees, that's a challenge. And it's a challenge that is not unique to us, but it is one that we, at this point, have been able to navigate. And I think by navigating it smartly, I do think that we can probably buck the trend, at least for some amount of time in the future. Some of the upsides for these types of employed models where optometrists are, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't sort of reflect on that. So upsides of these models for optometrists is, you know, we might experience a little bit more predictable income, especially in fluctuating healthcare times, maybe better benefits, reducing financial unpredictability associated with running a private practice. Now, most private practitioners that I know, they plan those things out well, have quite, you know, quite good financial stability. There might be, you know, obviously a perception of reduced administrative burden by being part of these models. Larger organizations all often mean less time spent on administrative tasks and more time available for patient care. You know, it can improve job satisfaction if you really want to perform and focus on clinical work and not have to worry about what else is going on in your practice. Now, many of these situations, as you kind of dig into it, that may not be the case, that you still have to focus on things that are going on in the day-to-day practice, but certainly there is that opportunity. In theory, employed settings may have more advancements or more access to advancements to advanced technology. And especially in larger healthcare systems, they often have the ability to, you know, conceivably incorporate more devices, more treatment technology. Now, one of the downsides, obviously, is that, you know, if you're coming into a group setting that has a lot of different offices and a lot of different types of providers, meaning, you know, types is in terms of how optometrists might practice. The take home from there would be if that group, that hospital or large organization doesn't see value of adding a lot of those types of testing or new treatment options or new devices into your practice, at every single location, you may not see the benefit of the economies of scale by purchasing in mass, for example. So to break that down and maybe to say it a little bit better, you know, if I see a widget, if I own 700 practices and I know that only 100 of those doctors or maybe even 10 of those doctors are going to really utilize that widget, I'm not going to see a lot of cost of goods saving by acquiring that widget for only 10. Versus the perception is that I could acquire 700, but if I buy 700 that never get used, then I'm losing a lot of money no matter how much I save. So, you know, obviously the idea of access to advanced technology is really important and possible. It may not actually translate into care if they're not able to move the metric on how optometrists might be practicing. But there are integrated, you know, one of the other upsides that I considered would be obviously integrated care models. So employment in large healthcare entities might facilitate a more integrated and multidisciplinary care, allowing for optometrists to collaborate more closely with other healthcare professionals. I think that could be a big benefit. You know, we've seen microcosms of this in other areas existing in healthcare, specifically in hospital systems, and then other, you know, locally in Omaha. But we've also talked to Dr. Paul Williams about what he's seen in Washington State. And when larger healthcare systems outside of optometry that would try to integrate optometry into those multidisciplinary care spaces often can struggle when they haven't perfected it before, or if they don't have optometry really running that part of the show, because it is such a unique dynamic between a retail opportunity within glasses and contact lenses as well as a healthcare system and healthcare specifically that's being delivered by optometrists. Clearly, there are downsides in employed models, and I'm definitely biased on the downsides for employed models. But you know, just to list a few, we have a loss of autonomy. Obviously, optometrists in employed settings may have less control over their work environment and decision making processes, including patient care protocols, scheduling, practice management. there's a potential for increased workload. So, you know, once a practice is purchased and a entity is trying to generate revenue from that practice, an employed optometrist might face higher patient values volumes as the healthcare system seeks to maximize efficiency and maximize revenue, which obviously can lead to burnout. And I think we're seeing a lot of that, maybe not just in optometry, but in healthcare in general. And it'd be interesting, I couldn't find any data specifically on burnout related to employees, specifically employed optometrists or employed other physicians, you know, other physicians who are employed, and their burnout rate. But obviously there is that potential problem. Now I could see burnout if you're, you know, running a private practice that is, you know, struggling, or, you know, has cash flow issues. I could see burnout becoming a big issue there. Limited scope of practice. You know, some employment settings, optometrists might be restricted to performing narrower ranges of services than they might in private practice. Again, I see this as limiting patient access to care, and I see it as limiting the skills that optometrists have or can utilize in those systems. And ultimately, I don't think that it's going to be, from my reflection, it's unlikely to happen, or it hasn't happened that I've heard of, that one of these systems have specifically told optometrists that they cannot perform certain services. Obviously, that does happen in hospital settings and VA settings. But in terms of what we're seeing in the profession right now with gobbling up independent practices, largely by private equity, I have not heard that they're telling them they can't practice a specific way. But one of the things that is important is that if that private equity group is seeing the optometrist as a widget or a cog in the wheel, and that wheel is mainly there to sell devices like glasses and contact lenses, then they're going to load up that doctor so that that's the primary outcome of what will happen when the doctor sees the patient, and that's the goal. And so if you can't find time in your workload to incorporate new technologies, new treatment protocols that you want to do for the best interests of your patient, then it may be challenging because you haven't figured out a way to incorporate that, and you're bogged down, or you're spending most of your time providing care that's related to the sale of glasses and contact lenses. And I see a whole lot of that challenge is that that's the model that you're set up in. Even if you tried to escape that model, let's say you didn't sell your private practice, let's say you just started in that model, it can be very hard, not impossible, and not even unlikely, but it takes a lot of extra effort to overcome those habits that you've built for a year, 2 years, 5 years by focusing on refractive care. And then obviously there's a dependency on the employed entity. So changes in strategy or financial health of that employing entity could directly impact optometrists. So while we think about the financial stability that might come from being an employee, you're no longer necessarily the master of your own destiny. And in those cases, you might see changes in compensation. You might have other market forces in terms of that might change that could cause the sale of those practices over time. And so to other entities that might not see the similar value that you were once being seen from your employment. You know, general considerations of this entire article is obviously there are market forces that are causing changes in the healthcare system, and healthcare providers are under large systems or corporations. They can diminish competition, you know, potentially affecting referral patterns and patient choice. I was having a conversation last weekend related to what things actually look like with vertical integration in the eye care setting. And so within eye care, we see lots of vertical integration. And we're seeing it in healthcare as well. So Optum has lots of, in this article mentioned, you know, Optum, and they have large vertical integration systems that will take pharmacy and physician reimbursement and physician services and do lots of different things to try to maximize the revenue that's generated from all of that under one roof. And that will change referral patterns. It, you know, arguably could could, in theory, it could reduce costs. That hasn't necessarily been borne out, and I'm not sure that that is likely going to be borne out. You know, one of the things that I was discussing last weekend with one of my friends was just the idea that, you know, forget about routine versus medical, but could I actually have a patient that right now has copays and high deductibles that last year spent, you know, $1,000 on all their medical care? And could I completely eliminate the opportunity or the option of taking any insurance at all, like medical insurance, vision insurance, and approach them when they come in and say, look, this is what your insurance allowed for us to charge you last year. Your insurance never kicked in and paid anything for that. But we can do it right now, direct care model, where because we don't have any of those administrative burdens and we're not taking any insurance at all, this would be the services that you'd need this year. This is the service that your insurance company said was worth, but we can do it for less. Could we actually do that? And could we actually get patients to accept that model? I suspect we probably could. It's not going to be easy. If we choose to do it as a practice, it's not going to be easy. I haven't made that decision. Also, I'm not sure I have the guts to make that decision because we have stability currently in the model, but there is this fragility that I could foresee in the future where patients who continue to bear the brunt and the complexities of getting paid and trying to figure out, you know, what copays are and what deductibles are, I could see a system that goes back away from a private payer or even a single party payer. You know, negotiating power, you know, we have lost the ability to negotiate with most payers. It's not just a problem with optometry, but it's a problem in the wider healthcare system. And this is a large problem for independent practices, private practices. And larger entities do have those systems built in place to do the negotiation. Cultural shifts, you know, as healthcare landscape evolves, you know, we've got to adapt to new models of care. And is this a new model of care? Obviously, it's not new. It's been around for a long time. But is this inevitable for us? I don't think so. I don't think it's inevitable. I don't think we're a dying breed of dinosaurs. I think that we have to be strategic in our partnerships. We have to be strategic in our alignment with one another. And I don't think that people who are practicing in, you know, corporate settings or for large hospital-based systems, they're not the enemy. We need them involved in our legislative battles, in our PAC funds, and we need to be able to reach out to them and bring them into the fold. And, you know, when I say we, I mean me as well. You know, it's not a judgment. I can see all the reasons why somebody might choose to practice in a corporate setting or a private equity setting. I can see all the reasons. I think they're all valid reasons. But I also think from a private practice standpoint, it has a lot of benefits for patient care, and it has a lot of benefits for the profession. And obviously I've said many of those on this podcast before, but we are one profession, and I think we're being fractured. I think these types of things are fracturing the profession, and ultimately that leads to challenges in patient care and makes it harder for our profession to continue to advance. And so I think it's important to consider those aspects of what's going on in healthcare in general. I hope that my reflection on this article, I hope this article was helpful for you to think about. I hope my reflection on the article was something that was thought-provoking for you. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave those thoughts in the comment section. As always, thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode.